You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I'm going to do a little mind dump today over some things that I've been reading a little bit more on, asking some questions, and just connecting some dots with some things that I've been seeing in the gym. Over time, when I had first started, obviously I started with Chico. So the first 3 years of my powerlifting career, I was coached by Boris Chico. Now, you know, one thing about a Chico program is he does have a giant emphasis on technique. It's, to him, the most important aspect of training. And I know this kind of flies in the face of a lot of recent things that I have seen on the internet and with other very successful coaches, conversations that I've had with them, our emphasis on technique seems to differ quite a bit. And, you know, I think it's not so black and white. I think there, obviously, you need to be lifting within the rules of powerlifting. And, you know, making sure that you're going to be safe within the lifts. And I think most of these coaches have like general rules that they want to see within the lifts, but they'll just let a little bit more go than I'm willing to let go. I think how we go about correcting them is just a little bit different at times as well. You know, one of the things, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, especially as I've had more conversations, I've read more things about technique and stuff. So when we talk about technique, we're just thinking that, like, you know, just it's how somebody does the lift, basically, right? But, it's much more complex than that. It's, you know, their neuromuscular coordination, their actual skill within the lift itself. And I remember going back, this might have been the second time that Chico came here to the States. He was talking about meeting Louis Simmons and their conversations. And I had asked him what the differences were between the two programs. And he said this directly, that Louis at Westside Barbell focuses on strength as the primary aspect of training, where he focuses on technique first. So that was the biggest difference between the two programs. Now, you know, in my head at the time, I think my interpretation of that was more Louis just lets them lift and adds more weight while, you know, Chico is more focused on volume, I guess, is the way to put it. But then, like, the more conversations I had, a lot of the coaches who might not hold technique to the same standards as somebody like Chico, they use a lot of volume. So that's not necessarily the biggest difference. This goes back a few months now. So when I first started coaching, basically everybody did Chico special exercises as the variations. So I was of the belief that, you know, the law of specificity even applies to our variations. So all our variations, and it made up the majority of our volume, at least 60% of our volume came from these special exercises within the competition lifts. However, for every variation we did on the squat, it was the same foot placement and bar placement where we would compete. For the bench, it was feet on the floor, full arch, comp grip. And for the deadlift, it was the stance that we would use in a competition. And we would just kind of analyze where the lift was breaking down technique-wise and then apply the appropriate special exercises to that circumstance. Now, this worked extremely well. And I think at the time, based off of my understanding of things, it helped simplify it and gave me options to try out with people and stuff. But over time, the more I learned, the more I talked to other coaches and stuff, I realized that maybe we need a little bit more variation in the lifts, because, you know, some lifters that I started with have now been with me for a prolonged period of time. You know, we're going on over 2 years in some cases. So I felt at times that they needed a little bit more. Just to, you know, change it up. And I kind of felt like we were getting everything we had gotten out of that program. So I started using more variations where we changed bar placement, foot placement, grips, and started messing around with things. Now, I think where I was at the time, you know, I've always had the belief that a skill within the lift was important, but, you know, so are like shoring up weak muscles and stuff. I mean, just coming from my background, it's hard to completely like just forget about the muscular components of things. So I know the Eastern Europeans have a giant emphasis on the neuromuscular coordination. Okay, it's just a fancy word for the technique, the skill level within the lift. And I do believe that it plays a critical role, but I don't think I fully bought into that aspect of it until recently, and I'll get into that a little bit more. So, you know, it's always looking at the lifts and analyzing the lifts where, you know, something like, oh, at the bottom, knee extension demands tend to be the highest. So, you know, our quads are the primary movers in this position. If we're pitching forward in the squat, it's probably because the quads aren't strong enough. You know, and I knew this flew in the face a little bit of what the Eastern Europeans were talking about, where, you know, typically those lifters can do a lot more on like a leg press per se. So it's not weak quads, it's just their skill level within the lift is actually poor. And I remember reading something also about Eastern European strength training where they actually believe sticking points were a result just of poor neuromuscular coordination. So as far as my understanding goes, this is why Borashiko uses repetitions of 85% and less for the most part within his training programs. Because after 85%, once we start getting up there a little bit higher, we start seeing sticking points and a breakdown within technique. So the goal is to be able to get enough work in without sticking points. This helps create a stable movement pattern that's harder to break down under heavier loads. The rationale behind it, so many people will be like, oh, you know, how can you prepare to lift heavy weights if you're only lifting 85%? So a double or triple at 85% is much harder than a single at 90 to 92%. That second or third rep that you're doing, the actual effort to complete that rep is harder than a single at over 90%. So that's the kind of takeaway from that. You know, and I would still attempt to fix these issues by using variations and stuff. You know, something like a pin squat. So let's strengthen the quads within the actual competition lift itself and see what happens. And I think many other coaches do very similar things with very good success. And this did yield some very good success. And I don't do it any differently now. But I'm somebody who definitely wants to know why things work so that I can better utilize these things. So I'm still asking questions to other coaches and, you know, doing a lot of research and stuff. And most of the research that you find on this stuff, it's EMG studies showing muscle activation at various points within the lifts or during different stances or bar placements and stuff like that, which is all good and grand. And in the giant scheme of things, I think it helps our understanding. But I've always had in the back of my mind, and like I was saying before, I never fully bought into the whole, oh, it's just a skill level, because, you know, I'm surrounded by, I think here we have a very different understanding. So I'm constantly having the, you know, you need to strengthen weak areas reinforced into me. So, you know, I think I've always just kind of skated around as it could be one or the other. And trying to identify that is obviously extremely tricky, but you know, you attack what you think, you know, somebody's pitching forward in the squat, you put the right variations in there to fix the technique and attack the quads with accessory work. I still don't think that's a bad plan. I just don't know if I fully believe what I believed before, in terms of how things work. So I started messing around with a lot more variation. So like I was saying, you know, we changed bar placement, foot placement. I made them lift in different angles. So again, having more conversations and reading more stuff about, you know, you don't need variations, you do need variations. And there's kind of these like two camps and stuff. And the argument for not using variations tends to be the law of specificity. You want to practice the exact movement so that you get better at it over time. However, what I started to see when I was changing up all of these variations is I was seeing improvements in the competition lifts that to me weren't making sense based off of my beliefs. So, for example, high bar wide stand squats I started using because I saw Detmar Wolf uses them a lot in his programs as an exercise. It kind of, you know, I kind of started thinking about it with the angles. This was more like muscle related, like based off of previous beliefs. So if we put the bar, you know, high bar wide stance, I can take a squat day and kind of target the same muscles that would be utilized in similar angles that would be utilized in a sumo deadlift. According to like EMG studies, the knee extension demands tend to be about the same, if not a little bit less for a wide stance squat as it would be for a competition squat. You put the bar high bar, typically high bar squats, you get an extra like 9-10 degrees of knee flexion. So that increased range of motion puts a little bit more stress onto the quads, but it seems like a wider stance puts more emphasis on the hip extensors, so like your glutes. So my understanding of this is, you know, I'll build up the hips and stuff. You know, I think originally I was like, this might have more carryover to the deadlift than it actually will the competition squat. I did think that there was some benefits to it for the squat, you know, teaching you how to use your legs, because you really can't just like throw your chest back and like grind it out. You know, for those like lifters that pitch forward a lot, how they end up locking out the weight, you know, using a lot of back in that and in those positions, like, you know, the torso gets pushed forward and then it's that hard lean back to get it into that lockout position. You know, I did think it would change it up a little bit and kind of, you know, show them how to use their legs. But, you know, we changed the bar placement and the foot placement, and it changes the angles of the squat quite a bit. So I wasn't sure what the technique carryover for the squat actually would be. What I started noticing with this lift was that a lot of the lifters that I had that were pitching forward weren't pitching forward anymore. And we weren't really targeting that at the time with like other, we were kind of just messing around with stuff. So it's not like we weren't targeting. I shouldn't say that, because there were tempo squats and comp squats in there at the same time. So the tempo will help that. But I started noticing that everybody who had the high bar wide stand squats that were pitching forward, we were seeing a drastic improvement in that technical era. So it got me thinking that, okay, maybe we can change technique a little differently than I had originally thought. And a lot of these were done in a short period of time too. So it's not like the quads just got stronger in 4 weeks. To build up actual strength in a muscle group like that under those types of loads, it takes time. So any short-term changes like that have to be neuromuscular. So it got me really thinking, you know, how does motor control actually work? Right, so I've been introduced to some of somebody like John Kiley's stuff, where he discusses a lot of the problems with old periodization models. So periodization models that we learn in school, I learned in undergrad and grad school, are kind of based off of old Soviet research that, you know, the Tudor Bompas of the world started to bring light to here in America. However, it was basically based off of Hans Seeley's general adaptation syndrome research. So this research was done in the early 1900s. So, you know, it's 100 years old. And we've learned a lot over that period of time with how the human body reacts to stress. One of the problems that he brings up with the periodization model, and I think this sheds light on it not necessarily being the most adequate way to create optimal results, is if everything just relied upon mechanical stress, results would be predictable and reproducible. We would know that if we increase, let's say, volume and or intensity by this, we could predict results. The problem with that is it is completely unpredictable. You could do the exact same program twice with the same person and not even get similar results, not to mention doing the exact same program with multiple people. It will work for some. It'll work really well for some. It'll work okay for some. Other people will just maintain, and others might get weaker. Like, there will be ranges of everything that occurs that you could think of, giving the same program to similar people. So what I think we, you know, this just raises a lot of questions. So when you start digging into, and I was first introduced to these concepts through pain science research about our expectations and beliefs being a part of the physiological pain. So it's not necessarily that the pain's in your head. If you have hip pain, the pain's in your hip. If you have back pain, the pain's in your back. However, your expectations and beliefs actually are part of that physiological pain. And to understand that, it's a hard concept, I think, to grasp. And I don't think I fully grasped it until just recently, how it might actually work. So, you know, reading John Kiley's stuff made me more flexible with the program. So there was a time and place where just run the numbers. You know, you don't need to go up, you don't need to go down, just do what's on the sheet of paper. And of course it works well because, you know, you hit the mark on most days. And the way that the structure of the programs is, in a week, I'll have, you know, typically a day above baseline, a day at baseline, a day below baseline. And it's all based off of volumes, right? Numbers of lifts at average intensities for the most part. So it's still going to work extremely well, you know, because you're controlling loads and you're increasing those loads over time. So you're gonna see results. So reading a lot of like Kylie's stuff and digging deeper into it, I became more flexible. So I started giving, you know, and I didn't want the load management aspect to get thrown out of whack. So I started giving the lifters more flexibility. So based off of the rep ranges that they have on their sheet, they can go up to a certain percentage and down to a certain percentage. They cannot go higher or lower without my okay on that, because that can actually throw off their week's volume. If they go up by more than 5% on one day, so let's say on squats, the next day that they squat, they actually have to drop those top sets down without my okay. This is just to make sure that our volume stays steady throughout the week, because even though I'm saying that the old periodization models based just on mechanical stress might be inadequate, it doesn't mean it's not important. Volumes are an important aspect of training. I think that's undeniable. However, it's just a piece. So, you know, I've changed up a lot of things. The variations are very different, and I'm starting to see people performing better technique-wise on the competition lifts. But I'm sitting there and I'm like, how do I know that it's not just they're practicing the comp lift more, they're getting stronger? Like, how do I know that that's not what's leading to the technique changes? So for a couple of the lifters on my team, and when they listen to this, they'll be like, oh, you used me. But for a couple of them, I removed competition lifts from their training altogether. So Kelly, she's been with me a little over a year. So she's still a beginner. And, you know, she came into the gym with no lifting experience. So, you know, I kind of, you know, there's still beginner gains and stuff. So it's not, take it for what it is. And it's a small sample size and stuff. Okay. So for 8 weeks, I removed her conventional deadlift. So she competed at regionals in August. I think her best deadlift at that meet was like 264 or something like that. The hips would rise up off the floor, and she was having a hard time kind of sticking with the weight and locking it out. So let's see, November before that, she had hit her first two-plate deadlift. Hips rose, back rounded a lot. So it had improved quite a bit over time. And over that period of 9 months, she put about, you know, 50 pounds. I think she hit 275 in the gym. So she put about 50 pounds onto her deadlift. So I completely took out her conventional deadlift. So this is something that we had trained for, I guess at the time, a little bit under a year. And we had seen improvements in her technique, but, you know, from November, the hips rising a lot, back rounding, to August, where the hips were rising first, still not as bad. The back was still rounding, not as bad. We did see improvements. However, you know, it was 9 months and there was still a lot of improvements that needed to be made. So I thought this was a perfect example, a perfect opportunity for me to kind of test a hypothesis. So I removed her conventional deadlift and we started pulling sumo. And then in my head, my plan was just to kind of, with the first block, let's just pull sumo. We'll put the right weights on the bar and kind of figure out what technique things needed to be worked on within that lift. So basically treating sumo as if it were the competition lift in a Shiko style program. So I would analyze her sumo deadlift and then apply the appropriate variation in the next block. So we did that. I think after, you know, we pushed numbers a little bit in the first block to make sure that there was adequate training stimulus. And this was the only, we only deadlifted one day a week. So I dropped volumes. So typically we would deadlift twice a week. So I dropped frequency and the second deadlift day tended to be a little bit lighter, but volumes were still lower. So 8 weeks, where 4 weeks competition sumo style deadlifts. Next 4 weeks, I'd have to go back and look. I think we did deficit sumo deadlifts. We might have done like a sumo deadlift plus deadlift below the knees. I forget which variations I gave. I gave which people. But anyways, I gave her one variation of the sumo deadlift to work on, still deadlifting one time a week. And this actually dropped volume from the block before, because obviously the comp style lift is a little bit easier. So after 8 weeks, on week 9, I put the conventional deadlift back in. So the sumo deadlift looks really good, and it was moving really well. You know, I think in a lot of cases, it's just a movement she hasn't messed up yet and, you know, has gotten stronger over time. So, you know, she can get some beginner gains off of it. But I wanted to see what the conventional deadlift looked like because that was the plan from the start. So we bring it back in. And the first week, she ended up taking 255 pounds, so around 10 pounds less than her best competition deadlift for a set of four or five. I'd have to go back and look. Not that that would be that difficult. For multiple sets, for like, I'm pretty sure it's five sets of four. So literally something that she had opened with in August, and here it is November. She's taken it for five sets of four. So the progress weight-wise is way more than she had seen in the previous 9 months. The interesting thing with this is the hips were staying down and the back was staying flat. So there was a lot of carryover into technique. 2 weeks after that, she took her more than her best ever competition deadlift for triples. She took 270 pounds for two or three triples. So, and same thing, hips were staying down. Everything was rising together with, you know, so a lot of improvements in technique. So if you just look at it from a biomechanical standpoint, you know, the conventional deadlift and the sumo deadlift have very drastic muscle differences. So, you know, the sumo, you're more upright, so it puts a hell of a lot more emphasis on the knee extensors, so your quads, to get it moving, and it actually changes the emphasis of the back muscles. I think the amount of back involved is roughly the same. It's just what part of the back is actually being targeted. Now, I will say during this time, to maintain back strength, I threw box squats in there. So she didn't like sit on the box. This wasn't like West Side style, but pushing her hips back further than she typically would on a competition squat just to get those similar angles. And we did a lot of like back accessory stuff like rows and stuff like that. So I didn't want performance to drop. And obviously I think accessories and changing angles are important for overall health regardless. However, within the lift itself, you know, the conventional deadlift's more back, less quads, and the angles are very different, but somehow she's much stronger with much better technique when there was just that one minor change. I also did the same thing to, so Emo Danielle, she has in the gym, she's her best squat's 305. She's been with me for probably a year and 8 months, I think it is. So she's been with me for a little bit longer, and she was lifting before that. So she had a previous coach. So she's got a little bit longer of a training background. Now, she's got, technique-wise, her squat's pretty good. Obviously, she squats 305 at 135 pounds body weight, right? It's more than twice her body weight. And, it, you know, 300 pounds for a girl is a decent amount of weight. And there are just some very minor technique things that I think she could improve to push those weights a little bit more. So, you know, like control at the bottom, keeping the upper back tight as she comes up. Those are like a few of the issues that have, you know, kind of been there since we started, but they'd get a little bit better. The weight would get heavy enough, push her around. You know, we kind of just tread a course. Her squat's gone up 60 pounds in the period of time she's been with me, so she's seen good progress. So for 8 weeks, I took out competition squats altogether. We did high bar wide stance squats, box squats, tempo squats, and then in the next block, I did more like, I took that high bar wide stance squat and I changed it. And I treated it as if it were the competition lift and added some variables to it. So like a pause halfway up, high bar, wide stance squats. So one of my things with this was, you know, obviously if she's losing the upper back and, you know, she has a tendency to lose control in the hold a little bit. She has that like chest fall error as she's coming up from the bottom of the squat. So I wanted to really see if I removed competition squats altogether and I put in, you know, the tempo squats are definitely going to help. I changed angles with the box squats, like pushing the ass back, which, you know, hopefully will teach you how to drive the hips forward. So basically I put in exercises that would just target this technique flaw without putting competition lifts in there at all. And then, you know, any technique flaws I saw in those variations, I did what I would have done as if it were their competition lift. So like pausing on the halfway up of a high bar wide stance squat because, you know, her knees were caving in a little. So 8 weeks, no comp squats. Week 9, her first time doing it, let her feel it out. She took 80% for some triples. You know, they felt a little awkward because she hasn't done them in so long, right? So then yesterday she had same thing, 80% for some triples, except, you know, I kind of wanted to see where performance would be. So instead of adding weight, because I easily could have done that because it looked pretty easy on the first three, you know, she's planning on maybe competing around the April time period. And right now I want to build some volume. So I wanted to test the skill level of the squat itself in some way. So, and I've been kicking around the idea of using AMRAPs occasionally to do this just to help maybe, you know, I use inflated maxes at times, so it might help me better predict those inflated maxes in training. She took her 80% of 245 pounds for a set of 10. You know, and this is only her second time doing competition squats in 10 weeks. And every rep looked exactly the same. Like it was straight up and down, a lot of legs, you know, legs and back working together. And, you know, I put an immense amount of fatigue and stress onto that to see if I could break it down. And it didn't break down. I even told her beforehand, I'm like, you know, let's aim for 6, but it had looked good. And I wanted to see a breakdown. I wanted to see if I was on to something. And the fact that she was able to get 10 of them, and even when it got sticky, you know, around rep 9 was pretty sticky and rep 10 was pretty sticky, but back stayed tight, chest was upright, everything moving together. Like there was no doubt she was going to come up with it. So, and this kind of coincided with, I had a conversation, which you will have heard that podcast. If you haven't listened to it, it should come out. It will be out first, probably a couple weeks before you're hearing this one, with Jason Tremblay of the Strength Guys, where, you know, he was talking about how he doesn't use a lot of variations. Now, in his program, it makes a lot of sense. So they track everything, you know, volumes, number of lifts, average intensities, all of that stuff. So if you start throwing variations in, it would absolutely mess with their system. Because it becomes, you're throwing a variable in something that they don't want a lot of variables in, you know, because of how they do things. It would throw things off. So, you know, I'm seeing all this stuff happen in the gym. I'm talking to him and I'm like, confused, I guess. So I was like, I wonder if I dig deeper into the motor control research, if I can find stuff. So, you know, I started digging around quite a bit, and all of a sudden I stumble upon this dynamic systems theory. So basically what this says is variability is important for motor control learning. So I'm going to try to explain this in an extremely simplified way that I think makes sense. So basically how things work, and this happens at both the conscious and the subconscious levels, is your body predicts outcomes, right? I think, you know, the funny thing is, I don't even know if I should put this on the air, but a thought that like came into my mind when I was reading this was Bev, one of my lifters. So she had zero lifting experience a year ago. She's been with me for a year. She does great. She never, ever, ever misses training days under any circumstance. And I would train all Bevs if that was an opportunity, for sure. So when she leaves, you know, and this is like this with everyone, like I love a good high five, but like I'll slap her hand pretty hard and she'll flinch, right? She'll flinch before I hit her hands, right? So basically how I interpreted things, and like I was saying, this happens both consciously and subconsciously, is your brain predicts outcomes, right? It's predicting those sensory feedbacks that are going to occur based off of the environment around it. So Bev would flinch because I'd give her a hard high five, right? And like it makes your hand sting a little bit. So her brain is predicting that sensory feedback that she's about to receive is going to hurt, so she braces herself for that. I mean, we experience those situations all of the time. You know, if we think something might be hot, how we approach testing it out. You know, you're driving your car and something's close, you kind of like bear down because you're predicting there might be an accident, and you're kind of bracing yourself for impact, right? The same thing happens when we're lifting. Our brain predicts sensory feedback outcomes and plans the best motor control strategy to apply to that situation. And then as we start doing the lift, it receives that sensory feedback and makes adjustments accordingly. So for the high bar wide stance squat to stop pitching, it's not necessarily that it's strengthening the quads. And I think, you know, as John Kiley pointed out, a lot of the strength research is very outdated in terms of periodization. I think it's very outdated in what we look at for the lifts and performance themselves. So I think what happens with the high bar wide stance squat is we're changing the brain's expectations of sensory feedback. Like that's a position that if you pitch even just a little bit, you need to correct it really fast, or you're going to fall over because of how vertical you have to be. That bar can get out in front pretty quick. So in a lot of cases, that becomes the limiting factor on how much somebody can actually lift within that variation. So I think what happens is it changes your brain's predictive processes. So you do that lift and you do other ones where, you know, you punish that falling forward pattern. So if my chest caves forward out of the hole, I can make somebody pause on the halfway up, right? If you're too far forward, you won't be able to pause. Changes it. Tempo, very hard to do if you're pitching forward. Like all of these exercises, I use these 1.5 squats where you go down, halfway up, down again, all the way up. Like where we spend a lot of time pin squats in that position, just punishing bad patterns, we'll call it, in the squat. So I think what this does is it changes the brain's predictive responses. So before, you know, we do all of those, we're going to do our first comp squat in a while, right? Now, the rules of those squats are all the same. The bar's on your back, you're sitting down, the goal is to keep the bar over the middle of the foot, you're hitting depth and coming up. So we're keeping the parameters very, very similar. So I think specificity still applies, but there's enough variability that it can get computed in the brain's predictive responses. So now we're going to hit a competition squat. The brain predicts sensory feedback. So now the sensory feedback is, if I fall forward, I'm going to fall over. So I need to be better prepared and have better strategies to come up out of the hole. So it plans those motor control patterns more appropriately for what we would call good technique. So you go down in the squat and you see that massive improvement. I think, you know, in a lot of cases, it's like, I would never take out the competition lifts. And I was this person literally a couple months ago. There were always competition lifts in my programs. At least 20% of our volume was coming from competition lifts. But now I'm starting to realize that maybe that's not necessarily appropriate if we're trying to change neuromuscular coordination. Because what we need to do is we need to create an environment. So this would be the gym and the exercises that we choose and all of those things. We need to create an environment in which we can change the brain's expectations and predictive responses so that pre-lift for the competition lift, it has a better strategy going into it. And I think if we leave the things in there that are leading to a less than desirable effect. So if I left the competition lifts in there for Kelly and Danielle, I am not so sure that we would have seen the same increase in performance, because, you know, let's say they're 20% of the volume. That means 20% of those reps are reinforcing those previous behaviors. So it's going to be harder to change predictive responses when a good chunk of them is reinforcing the old predictive responses. So removing them completely, I think, helps almost reset the system in a way. And then have every exercise target that one thing that you're trying to fix technique-wise and just hammer it until, you know, basically what I was looking for when I was lifting, when I was watching them lift, is obviously like improvements in those variations, but I want to be able to load them. So can we get up to the 80% range for doubles and triples in all of these variations? And in a lot of cases, you can't do that at the start. So once we get up there, I'll take them out, add in the competition lifts, and like I'll keep variations in there as long as I can actually like stretch some type of progress out of them. And then, you know, you'll see that variation kind of level off and you're kind of stuck. That's when I'll take it out and add in a new one or change it up to make it harder and then work that one back up. You know, and I think this, we bring other things into perspective, like for me. So I had newer lifters that came to me from other coaches. And this is by no means like bad mouthing other coaches, but you know, they may not have seen these as issues and just wanted them to train through it. And that's their thing. I don't think that's right, but to each their own. But Ariel and Allie were pitching forward quite a bit in the squat. So when they'd come up, their hips would rise to a point where their chest was almost parallel to the floor. So it's a big chest fall. And I would, and like this always worked for me, like this is just something I learned from Chico, is you can use the same weights but challenge positions more. So it might start with, you know, something like light tempo squats and then a pause on the halfway up and then a 1.5 squat and then pin squats. Like all of these, some of them are harder than others. And obviously you can change the environment changes to change predictive processes don't necessarily just mean variations, like rep ranges and intensities of variability as well. So with them though, I would use literally less volume than they were used to, and they would just repeat weights basically every week until I started to see improvements. I mean, this went, you know, 12, 16 weeks of utilizing the same weights with just throwing a different tweak onto it to try to fix an issue that was going on. You know, and I think we always just view overload as volume, like this person needs more volume. We can overload efficiency by making the variations that we're using more difficult. Like I could take a competition squat, let's just say 80% for doubles or triples or whatever. If I decide to pause at the bottom, right, I'm making that lift harder. I'm overloading the efficiency of that position, right? And then if I add a pause on the halfway up, same thing. You're going to slow down out of the hole that you're used to, so it's changing tempo a little bit. You're challenging their motor control patterns in different ways, right? So the overload is happening there as opposed to just being volume overload. And I wrote an article a few weeks ago saying how volume's not necessarily the only thing. And this is why some lower volume programs work, higher volume programs, and it's different for everybody. And I think the differences lie in because of how complex we are, right? There are so many variables that go into that predictive decision-making process by the brain. You know, things such as if we're scared of the weights, right? We expect certain things to happen. That changes how we are going to take that lift. If we're in a bad mood, if we're sick, like there are a number of issues that affect those processes, right? So you know, that's why it's not linear. It's just there's no way to be able to control all of them. You know, I find it to be an extremely interesting aspect. And, you know, I had started, obviously, my coach telling me that neuromuscular coordination, it's the end all be all kind of, right? But like, you know, you want to build up weak muscle groups and stuff because that's what, you know, it might have some carryover. You know, I went from being, oh, it's a skill, but still not entirely sold and not believing 100% in it, to kind of swinging almost the other way, because most of the research I'm reading is like, the quads have the greatest emphasis here, the glutes here, the back here. Here's this EMG study showing these things with this bar placement, this foot placement. At the end of the day, I think our research is looking at the wrong things. We're not just a giant sack of muscles and nerves. There's a lot more that goes into it. And you can have the world's strongest quads in a leg extension or leg press or, you know, a body weight, you know, externally loaded single leg squat. It doesn't mean your actual competition squat is going to be good. I don't think that there's much carryover from accessory work into the main lifts. I just, physiologically, it just doesn't make sense to me. This doesn't mean that accessory work is not important. I think it's extremely important for building volume tolerance at different angles. You know, let's say we're doing 100 squats in a week, but then we have some leg extensions and lunges or whatever else people put in there for accessory work. I think it increases the load tolerance at the knee joint, which is a commonly injured area, right? Not injured, but an area that tends to have a decent amount of pain. I've seen quad tears happen. Granted, this is mostly with knee wraps as opposed to raw lifters, but that stuff happens. So I think that extra loading builds resiliency and is extremely important for health. And I also think you should load the accessories heavy for those reasons, because you're trying to prepare. Obviously, one, the more weight that you lift and stuff, you're increasing volume, but at the same time, I think, you know, you get a little bit more carryover into those areas. But I think it's more for overall health than it is for actually transferring into performance. I think building the quads within the squat itself, right, would be a better argument. But even then, I think the increase in muscle mass, again, our body responds to the outside environment, becomes more of a byproduct of training appropriately within the squat. I think your body responds to squatting, so it puts on the muscle mass and develops the motor control patterns and all of that. Like, I think that's just like improved technique is a byproduct of training and stuff. I think improved muscle mass is the same thing. I think targeting it in accessory work is important, and I'm not changing how I do that type of stuff, but I don't think there's carryover into the main lifts at all for that stuff. I think the carryover is keeping you healthy so that we can increase volumes at the right times. Because like I said, even though I said volume's not the only thing that matters, I do think it's important. And as we get closer to competitions, I will use far less variations than I've used in the past. And we will use predominantly all competition lifts, you know, I'm kind of fucking around with the time period, and I think this will be different for everybody, but let's say 6 to 8 weeks out from a meet, literally all competition lifts, unless I think there's a variation that I can still drag out a little bit for some increased gains type of thing. We'll do that, but the majority of our volume is going to come from competition lifts, where before I would run variations, yeah, it'd be a lot less than it would be further away from a meet, but there were still quite a few variations in there and stuff leading up to a competition, and now I'll just basically use them as like a load management tool, and we'll just competition lift right up to our test and taper and see how that works. I think even then, I think our ratios will be the same. It's just kind of how I structure the entire thing. But I think where I ran into some problems with my programming before is I was conflicted and not fully understanding whether it was technique or weak muscles, right? Like, it was in my head, I was always like, oh, well, it could be one or the other. And like, oh, this will build up this muscle group, so this should help. But I think if my why for using that exercise is incorrect, I'm not going to yield as great success as I could if I understand the whys. And the more I look into it and the more I look into my experiences, I 100% think it leans more towards the neuromuscular coordination of things being what I need to focus on, because, you know, I want to just bring this full circle. So like I mentioned my talk with Jason, where he doesn't use any variations and really focuses on the volume aspect of things. And me, where I use a ton of variations and I focus more on the technique aspects of things. I think this is similar to the Chico Louis Simmons thing, where it's technique versus strength. So if I'm going to focus on technique, everything I put into my programs need to focus on that neuromuscular coordination aspect of training. Where if I try to focus too much the other way, I'm going to miss out on what I'm trying to improve upon. And I think if Jason did things more with variations and stuff, his program would suffer as well. I think, you know, the great thing about powerlifting is it's a big enough world for multiple systems to work. This doesn't mean that you can just do one set and you'll be okay. Volumes need to be at various points. So I kind of, you know, I use the acute chronic work ratio for this, but I kind of use baseline volumes, and I might repeat that same baseline volume in the following block if I'm seeing results and stuff. If it looks too easy in training and stuff, you know, we'll add sets, we'll do all that stuff, and we progress those volumes over time. Once those lifts actually start looking easier, I might use an inflated max so that we're making sure we're at least hitting baseline volume. But one thing from the Chico program, analyzing my Chico program, that I noticed is I would go months without spikes in volume. And in some of those months, I saw my biggest progress. And I remember reading an article that looked into one of Chico's lifters that competed at Worlds, at IPF Worlds. And for 12 weeks, it basically, you know, you'd have days above baseline, days at, and days below, but the average would always be around baseline. There weren't spikes in volume. And that's, you know, 12 weeks out from a meet. And then obviously you have the drop off for the taper. So I think one of the things that, you know, being stuck in the middle, there were times where I would just drive volumes instead of sticking to what I was doing before and just being more critical on the analysis of the lifter and really focusing my attention on those things that need to be fixed and putting the right exercises at the right intensities, at the right volumes, at the right times. I think I have a better grasp of that now within the last few weeks than I did before. And, you know, a lot of it just comes with, yeah, I've read stuff, but what I've seen in the gym and my experiences coaching. So, you know, we'll see how that works as we move along. As of now, though, like the changes that I've made to these programs is yielding some really good results. You know, I have other lifters that have been taking, you know, 90% for doubles on some of these variations. Like, I think you do get some beginner gains from angles and exercises you haven't done before. And even if it's building confidence, right? Because confidence increases that expectation, right? If your pre-lift expectation is, oh yeah, I took this for a high bar, wide stance, double, I can hit this no problem. You know, I think the change in that expectation, that confidence also might be the reason why you're seeing improved results by doing these things, along with changing predictive processes. So, you know, I'm going to keep fucking around and we'll see what happens. Maybe I'll have Mike Amato come on here and discuss more about dynamic systems theories and how it fits into this stuff at some point so that we can get some more info out there. You know, and we'll go from there. Follow me on Instagram, KW Can, our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.